Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. In the spring of 2007, a series of cyber attacks targeted governmental agencies, financial institutions, and businesses in the Baltic nation of Estonia. Over the course of several days, the attacks took government services offline, hijacked the websites of the country's newspapers, and crippled commerce, grinding daily life in the country to a halt. The culprit behind the offensive was Russia, which had been outraged by Estonia's decision to relocate a famous Soviet-era statue. Moscow responded to the dispute by launching what experts have called the world's first cyber war. To this day, the episode stands as an example of Russian capabilities and of how wired societies are vulnerable to attack and exploitation by hostile actors. It's one with important lessons for Western societies, which now find themselves under a similar kind of assault from the Kremlin. Russia's information warfare strategy may not be aimed at taking computers and websites offline directly, but it's targeting the free flow of information that all of us have come to rely upon in order to spread propaganda, to sow political dissent, and to destroy trust in democratic institutions. To get a little bit more insight into the Estonian experience and its lessons, the current threat posed by Russian propaganda, and the larger communication landscape facing us today, I spoke with Tomas Ilves. Tomas Ilves served as Estonia's president from 2006 until 2016. He was previously a diplomat and a journalist, as well as a member of the European Parliament. Since 2016, he's played the role of a global statesman and a pioneer of digital freedom. He is currently, among many other things, a member of the advisory board of the prestigious Munich Security Conference. President Ilves, it's a real privilege. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Let's start with the events of 2007, which took place on your watch as president of Estonia. Can you talk a little bit about the context of the conflict, how it played out in your country?
Well, the context was that the government of Estonia decided to move a Soviet-era statue that had become increasingly a point of contention and provocation in the middle of the city as kind of a rallying point for people nostalgic for the Soviet Union and expressing increasingly violent support for the Soviet Union and sort of the existence of Estonia. And when it came to be already a public nuisance, then the government decided that it would take this monument and move it to a military cemetery, which would be more appropriate for it anyway. This was then followed by riots, the only riots we've ever had in the 30 years of Estonia being again an independent country. And in the process, websites stopped working, and which quickly we came to see realized were DDoS or distributed denial of service attacks. What you have to know about DDoS attacks is that they would overload a server so it can no longer respond. Now, they did this to all the banks, to all government sites, and there are a lot of government sites, to the point where all the newspapers, communications, banking, government functioning were all disrupted in a big way, to the point where no banking transactions were no longer possible. And I went to our CERT, which is the cyber emergency response team. Every country has one. I mean, big countries, lots of them, but we have one. And they showed me how how one progressed. This was an organized attack. Now, where this becomes interesting is that if you think about von Clausewitz's definition of war, which is the continuation of policy by other means, this was the first time that you ever actually had foreign policy or aggression being committed by non-kinetic means. And every history book ever written so far and probably for the future on cyber war will begin with the attack on Estonia. Now, also important to know two things. One is that a DDoS attack, you don't get in. They never did that. They completely eliminated our access to our critical infrastructure. While that was the first time that really it happened at a nation level, we have seen this applied a lot ever since. A year later, during the Georgian-Russian War, the Russians would blank out areas of Georgia with DDoS attacks before a bombardment began. And then they would, so you would be really lost in the Clausewitzian fog of war because you had no idea what was going on. Now, later on, one of the sort of positive effects of this is that because we are a digitized country, we had already been pushing in NATO for 3 years that, look, we need, NATO has all these centers of excellence. They have 80 of them or more, but they had nothing for cyber. And they kept pushing us all, saying, nah, this is not serious. Well, after this, they realized that cyber attacks, in fact, can be extremely serious and a huge threat. And as a result, Estonia ended up getting the NATO Center of Excellence for Cyber Defense in Tallinn, Estonia. But yeah, this is part of a larger picture, which we can perhaps talk about later on. But with force equals mass times acceleration, well, Newton's second law has been the basis of all warfare up till the beginning of this millennium. It was kinetic. I mean, you had to hit somebody, be it a bomb, a trebuchet, bow and arrow, throw weights, you know, it's all of that was based on Newton's second law. That's no longer true. So basically, we have to rethink what force means from this millennium on.
That's perfect. And I want to drill down a little bit later on the question of NATO and how international organizations have been responding to this new strategic context. But let me ask you first, because you referenced it in your answer, one of the reasons that the Russian attacks had such an outsized impact on Estonian society is because Estonian society is largely gone digital. It's wired in terms of services and government operations. How did the Russian attacks change how you and your government thought about connectivity? What are the lessons learned that you took away from the Russian cyber assault? How has Estonia adapted since?
Well, we had already gained a potential DDoS attack when it happened, just about 4 weeks beforehand, because we were getting ready for elections. And so we already had set up some mirror sites, which then if we were attacked would, we could bypass servers, but didn't do a good enough job. Now, since then, a lot of attention has been paid to the whole issue of dealing with DDoS attacks, and we're much better prepared, as is our critical infrastructure. But you're right. I mean, the thing is, if you're very digitally developed, that's a new vulnerability that if you don't have any digital infrastructure at all, clearly it's not going to have any effect on your country. And so the more digital a country becomes, the greater the number of vulnerabilities that it has to face. Not nearly as great as the vulnerabilities of zero-day exploits, but yeah, they're there. And so we have been constantly building up our resilience in response to these various threats.
So let's zoom out a little bit. Over the last several years, Russia has made a major effort to target its neighbors and nearby nations with an onslaught of fake news. Estonia hasn't been immune from this trend, but I wonder, what does this look like inside Estonia itself? What are Russia propaganda outlets saying there? Are they being listened to by the population? It's a very interesting thread to pull on.
Well, you have to realize that in the case of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the disinformation has been going on for much, much longer. And even in the pre-digital era was something that was constantly directed toward us. Russia never really accepted the independence of the Baltic countries after 1991. And so those kinds of propaganda against us and lies and disinformation have been spread since even before we became independent, since they used these lies and disinformation against us among Western countries. And I guess where the problem was that in general, the kinds of outlandish things they make up don't really have an effect here. I mean, if they're about Estonia, but if they're about Estonia and sort of foreign affairs related, they don't have an effect. They do have had an effect and did, especially in the 1990s, among the US, the Germans. So they would spread something about us that was not true. And then we had to jump hoops sometimes about stories that were told about us. Now, where it has had an effect, but this is not just us. This is basically everyone is really risen as the anti-vaxxer campaigns. And this is, I mean, you saw this already before COVID, when there was a massive amount of anti-vax disinformation directed against Italy, which was having a measles breakout. I mean, this is actually quite offensive. I mean, in the sort of military sense, offensive. I mean, kids will die if you go below herd immunity for measles. And they were really promoting this. And actually, at that time, Italy was being targeted. But you can see that the anti-vax stuff is being directed all across Europe, and it is being picked up by social media, being picked up by various dubious websites that are domestic. And we've seen the same phenomenon with anti-gay propaganda. There is a strong affinity, as you know from your domestic situation in the United States, between the hard right, the extreme right, and the propaganda that Russia tailors to these audiences. And so in every country in Europe, basically, and also obviously the United States, you have, through various intermediaries, you have the Russians pushing an anti-gay agenda with some effect. Well, actually, I should back up. I mean, if I look at the history of this, I think the real sort of the understanding you can use social media and digital means to affect change, political change, started with the Arab Spring in 2011, where Russia was not an actor, but it observed that by using Twitter and Facebook, you can achieve massive political effects. Look, without any resources, you can overthrow governments. So the various authoritarians looked at this, yeah, right, without any resources, you can do this. But imagine if we put our resources into this and we start pumping millions and millions into troll labs, troll farms, we start making up all kinds of news. What happens when we start making fake sites, as we saw in 2016? And so with the war in Ukraine, 2014, you saw this really come in heavily with Russians putting out all kinds of fake news. So, but then you saw it really actually used to great effect, beginning with the 2015 referendum in the Netherlands on the Ukrainian association agreement with the European Union, which had been negotiated and was in place. But it needed, and usually these things don't need ratification. But first, through this focusing on Netherlands, where they had this incredibly low threshold to call for a referendum, this was followed by a massive, massive propaganda attack on how bad Ukraine was. And in fact, the referendum went down as a result of this, which basically by EU law meant that the association agreement wouldn't come into effect. And then we saw it applied next in a big way with the Brexit referendum, and the British government has, in fact, hidden the results of the investigation of the role, presumably because it would be too damaging to come out and say, yes, Russian propaganda actually affected the outcome of it, because the difference between the two sides was actually very minimal. So, I mean, the scandal that would erupt and the kind of the overall disruption of UK society, if it should turn out that the government, the people fell for this. I'm not sure if it's much better to just batten the hatches and say, we're not going to let anyone know what we discovered, but it smells quite a bit. And then, of course, I mean, as we have read about and seen the 2016 presidential election in the United States. And I guess the next really big case of a somewhat different form of digital manipulation, which perhaps in the US is less well known, is that in 2017, May, you had the French presidential election, where Emmanuel Macron's server was breached, hacked. But the French had learned, and they were actually quite clever. So what they did was, they, having seen that the DNC server in the United States had been breached and doxed, I mean, all this stuff was released, they actually seeded their server with really obvious fakes. So when they were hacked, they were doxxed, but the problem was that in their desire immediately to push out really damning information about Emmanuel Macron's corruption, what they released were things that were obviously fake. And so the entire effort fell flat.
Right. And you touched on quite a bit on what's been happening in Europe. So a question relating to that. The EU and NATO have both made a lot of noise over the last couple of years about the need for a unified, what they call a rapid response mechanism to counter Russian disinformation. And as you laid out, this is actually something that they've been thinking about for a long time. But where do we stand in this process?
We're at the still at the thinking about it stage. I mean, little steps have been taken, but not proportional to the threat. So, I mean, there is based in Riga, Latvia, a strategic communications center of excellence, which is supposed to deal with disinformation, but that is restricted by its mandate, as is the cyber one, in that if there is disinformation about NATO, the organization, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, then they can report on it. But if there is if there's disinformation about something happening in the country, which is not true, but it's not tied to NATO itself, they don't have a mandate to actually write about it or research it. When it comes to the European Union, well, the decision was made under the previous administration that, well, you can do this, but each country has to pay for it itself, and we're not going to have like a EU response to it, but we'll give you some rooms in Brussels. I mean, this has more to do with the leadership or the previous administration. It's not really much better now, I should say. But in any case, I mean, also the administration on its foreign security team have not come from countries particularly savvy when it comes to these issues either, which is another problem. But I mean, if the people who lead the thing don't get it, then you don't get anything happening either. So it's fairly minimal. On the other hand, I must admit, I mean, this is a much bigger issue, is that people do not understand the nature of these threats, unfortunately. And so there's a given the possible effects and when the effects that we have seen, that these threats are far greater than the weight that is given to it. And if you think it through, invading Europe getting into a war with NATO is an expensive and risky proposition. On the other hand, if you want to disaggregate NATO, to use the late Donald Rumsfeld's term for the same thing, well, you can start. I mean, it's much cheaper, easier. It's very cheap compared to like a war to get someone elected to a NATO country that will pull that country out of NATO. I mean, that's Marine Le Pen in 2017. One of her main points was, we will leave NATO and we will leave the European Union. Now, she was defeated. Nonetheless, I mean, you can see that, you know, you see anti-EU, anti-NATO candidates in virtually every election in every country. And I mean, there's a clear reason for this. I mean, as long as you have something like NATO or you have the European Union, that Russia's small, Russia's poor, Russia's weak compared to those entities. However, if Europe consists of individual nations not bound by a defense treaty or not bound by rules of common action in the European Union, well, then Russia's huge. Compared to any country in Europe. I mean, Germany's 80 million, Russia's 142, you know. Every country is small if they are disaggregated, and therefore, you know, salami tactics can do all of that stuff much more easily if Europe is this patchwork of unrelated countries.
All right, I want to circle back to where we started our discussion and spend a few minutes on the question of the internet, which we know is both a vital tool of connectivity, and it's also a medium that's being exploited to advance authoritarian messages and authoritarian ideas. You've been a champion of the internet as a tool for empowerment of people in unfree societies. What we're seeing now, though, is a drift in the opposite direction as repressive regimes throw up barriers designed to prevent their populations from accessing the web. And other countries are doing even more. Russia, as you know, is building what it calls a sovereign internet, while China is drifting towards the same sort of thinking about its access to the World Wide Web. What's the challenge here, do you think? And how do we best respond to it?
Well, you can see actually that, I mean, Russia's this week took a big step toward its own sovereign internet in which Navalny's website is not accessible. I mean, it's a website that doesn't exist in Russia. I mean, you can shut it down in Russia, but you can't access an outside website anymore for Navalny. And this is just the last couple of days. Well, I mean, I fear the where it will go is a splintering of the internet. I mean, there's an even a term, the splinter net, but. And so far, the Chinese have been able to do it. The Russians are moving in that direction. Now, where we have not gotten is the West doing it. We are still free and open. The question is, how long will that remain so, if in fact you have this this massive asymmetry where nothing goes into Russia or China that they don't want, and we allow everything to come in, you know, it's a matter of time before someone starts saying, wait a minute, this is kind of silly, we'll do the same. And we have not done that. I cannot imagine on what basis that might happen, but certainly, I mean, there will be political pressure in that direction.
And that, of course, brings us to social media, which has emerged as one of the most vexing problems in the public diplomacy space. It's obviously a keynote for disinformation, as we've discovered, and its major players are also largely ungovernable and unregulated, which is something that the US Congress is grappling with currently. How should we think about social media in the context of propaganda and fake news? Can anything be done to make social media companies more accountable?
Fairly little. I'll tell you right off the bat, fairly little. I mean, the anger against basically US social media companies, since in the West, the U.S. social media companies. Well, basically, it's Facebook dominate. And the, you know, basically, if you're going like once a month, you find out they once again have done something really sleazy, lied, hidden, shutting out researchers. I mean, all of these things have a cumulative effect that at some point will come crashing down on them. I don't know when that will be, but the cavalier kind of move fast and break things sort of approach of Zuckerberg is that they've broken so much that and so irresponsibly and arrogantly that I think it's inevitable that there will be a major pushback, at least in Europe. In the US, it's harder to say because you know, they have huge resources to lobby Congress and have been quite effective at it. But, you know, I mean, especially when you have this, there's not only that front, the other front that they're, where they have, at least in the case of Europe, managed to get everyone annoyed is that while social media makes its money, and not only social media, also search engines like Google, make their money from scraping the data of users and making huge amounts of money off this. It's something that relies on the number of people you can scrape. Now, Germany has 82 million people, France has 60 million, Spain has 50, UK, I mean, it's not even in the EU, but still, you hundreds of millions of users, yet they pay their taxes in Ireland with a population of 3.5 million. They're not making their money in Ireland. They're paying their taxes in Ireland with the extremely favorable tax rate that doesn't take into account any of this stuff. And this, of course, understandably has gotten Europe really annoyed. No government, be it European or the United States, likes it when people don't pay their taxes. So that you have that battle, which is this kind of perception of them as being exploitative, and then the disruptive effects of disinformation, and I mean, in the case, I mean, also kind of a lot of unmonitored bad speech, which in the European Union does not have as strong a legal defense as United States. I mean, every democratic country in Europe has defenses for or protections for freedom of speech, but there are limits that exist in Europe which don't exist in the United States. But the failure of the social media companies to police that on their own, again, has caused a bit of a stir. The real problem we face is a lack of a coordinated response to all of this stuff, be it hacking or be it social media. If you look at the problem we face, it's actually a two-dimensional problem. One of the problems is silos in between people, within institutions, organizations are supposed to deal with it. The kind of example is that we have a NATO Cyber Center of Excellence. We have a NATO Strategic Communications Center. Now, this new phenomenon that I've been dealing with a little bit are deep fakes. I mean, the potential for abuse of deep fakes is huge. You know, we see the cute examples having, you know, Obama saying something, but what happens if you make a deep fake of a non-existent bribe, right? Someone gives money. I mean, you can really, it's huge. So I went to the cybersecurity center and said, look, this is a problem. I mean, what are we going to do? And they said, well, that deals with content. And we don't really deal with content. We just look at, you know, the technical side of things. Well, then I went to the NATO Center for Strategic Communication or Disinformation. I said, look, here's a real problem. And this is coming up and said, yeah, well, we agree it's a problem, but you know, that's technical. We only deal with content. So I have this silo problem. You have the silo problem in every country's institutions. You have them in the international organizations. But the other problem is we don't talk across borders. Now, the same two hacking groups, I mean, you can generalize this to a lot of them, but just take two, APT28 and APT29, Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear. They have hacked into the German parliament, the Bundestag. They've hacked into the State Department. They've hacked into the German think tanks. They've hacked into the German foreign ministry, but they've also hacked into the Italian foreign ministry. They've hacked into the Dutch foreign ministry. I mean, they've hacked into everything. And it's not even that they do just governments. They, in fact, hacked into WADA, which is the World Anti-Doping Agency, after it turned out that, you know, WADA had data showing that the Russian Olympic team was doping, right? So, but we don't, you know, the Germans don't talk to the Dutch, don't talk to the Americans, don't talk to the Italians, etc. I mean, because every country looks at its own problems. And since it's not something dealt with across borders, which has a lot to do with the history of cyber in general, which is that cyber grew out of places like NSA and GCHQ in the UK. It was like the background is in intelligence, which you guard like hell. You don't let anyone know. So, I mean, so cyber has grown out of this. But, you know, countries still are in that mindset. Oh, we won't tell anyone else that we've discovered this. And I mean, frankly, the best example happened to us, which is that about, 12 years ago or so, we discovered a worm in our military net, a Russian worm. So we said, oh, this is very interesting. And we went to NATO and said, look, we discovered a Russian military worm in our network. And the response of NATO was, oh, you too, which is not the response you're supposed to get in NATO, right? So so the real thing is to get much more integration on these fronts, both laterally and vertically and horizontally. But I think we need a bigger, even more extensive change in thinking, because as I mentioned before, we now live in an era, I mean, where kinetic warfare, while it hasn't gone away, as we see from Afghanistan, but digitization of war and of security is what distinguishes the 21st century, the new millennium, from everything that has preceded it. And this also has implications for things like NATO, because NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's not because everyone loves the North Atlantic so much. It's because, you know, there's the political decision. These are our allies. And then it's the North Atlantic because that's based on bomber range, fighter refueling, tank logistics, all of that stuff is geographic. But geography doesn't matter anymore. Canberra, Australia is as far as Canada, is as far as Cambridge in the UK. They're all equidistant in digital. Force no longer equals mass times acceleration. But what that does is that for countries like Japan or Australia or New Zealand, which are our sort of spiritual allies, or you could say liberal democracies, they're not in NATO. But if we're going to have a genuine defense for liberal democracies, well, then there's no reason why they couldn't be in that. And I would see the direction to work in is to actually create something other than NATO, which is not based on geography, which is not NATO or EU based, but rather based on sort of, do you believe in the fundamental rights and freedoms of a liberal democracy? And then you're in. And if you don't, and with your behavior, then you're out. So I think that's the future of security.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. and for all the ideas about both the lessons of the Estonian experience and also where we're heading in the future.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.